KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
To Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston at 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston at 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville at 89.7 HD2. We are Houston's community media. On this show, we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host, editor, and assistant producer is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
It's that time, folks. March 5th is primary elections. If you have applied for a mail-in ballot and have not yet received it, do check with the county clerk in your county to see if there's a problem. You can fill out and mail in your ballot as soon as you want if you have it. You don't have to wait for early voting to start, which conveniently it actually already has. Do make sure you have enough postage. Early voting centers are open until Friday, March 1st. They are open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and noon to 7 p.m. on Sunday. On Election Day, Tuesday, March 5th, polling places will accept voters from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. As long as you are in line by 7 p.m., they cannot turn you away. Sample ballots are now available for the primaries. Visit the What's on My Ballot page at harrisvotes.com and enter your name or address to see all the contests and candidates you're eligible to vote on. You can bring handwritten notes or printed sample ballots to the voting booth. Just be sure to take them with you when you leave. Your local election clerk outside of Harris County should also have local ballots online. The deadline to apply for a mail ballot is February 23rd. This show will initially broadcast on the 21st, so if you have not already put an application in the mail, it's probably too late to do so. However, if you haven't and you're determined, you can call the county clerk and see where you would need to hand deliver an application if that is a choice you decide to make. Let's see. And we will have a joint primary this year, and I have a link to offthecuff.com explaining that. And Andrew also has some comments on primaries.
Yes, I have some information. Remember, the March 5th primaries are for the Democratic and Republican parties only. The Texas Green and Libertarian parties have precinct nominating conventions up first for Harris County. These will take place on Tuesday, March 12th at 7 p.m. And you can only participate if you did not vote in the March 5th primaries. For more information, check txgreens.org/calendar or lpharris.org/calendar.
Our first story is from communityimpact.com. League City seeks resident input on future development through new digital tool. League City is seeking resident input on how to develop its remaining land with a new tool launched within its League City Listens platform. Launched on January 8th, Talk About Town, which is linked to in the article, is accessed through League City Listens webpage, or it can be accessed directly from the link I've included with the blog post. It also provides information on local business updates and newly opened businesses. It also currently hosts a survey to gather feedback about what type of business development residents would like to see in League City. Debuted in summer 2023, League City Listens is an interactive digital tool providing a way for citizens to engage with upcoming projects, plans, and initiatives in the city. Survey questions include, would you like to see more restaurants? Would you like to see more employment opportunities in League City? Would you like to see more entertainment opportunities in League City and some others? As of February 16th, 40 participants have taken the survey, said Amber Padigo, Manager of Community Engagement and Special Projects. Padigo added that the survey will remain open for another 3 months. Survey respondents also have the option to rank their preferences for the type of development they'd like to see from least to most important. So far, the most popular categories have been retail, restaurants, developed parks, and family-oriented entertainment, Padigo said. Padigo went on to say, it's a tool that we can use to give to our elected officials and to our department heads that they can use as League City continues to grow. The platform also includes a business locator map allowing users to discover new businesses in League City. Users can also submit questions or concerns to League City's Director of Economic Development, who will then provide an open-faced response that will be visible to everyone, Padigo said. Resident feedback from Talk About Town won't be the sole driving force behind how League City develops the remaining 40% of its undeveloped land, but it will be a tool the city uses to guide development strategies, Padigo said. League City is expected to double within the next 10 to 15 years, according to the city's website. Andrew?
I looked at the survey and was happy to see an option for undeveloped parks, as I believe that a city developing 100% of its land leaves too little habitat space for local wildlife and native plant life. I hope enough League City residents share my view for there to be a good portion of land left undeveloped in the final plan.
And I think, actually, Andrew makes an excellent point. Not all parks have to be developed. Something along the lines of Houston Arboretum can also be appropriate. The Arboretum is a semi-developed area with pathways, a visitor center, and parking area that still leaves plenty of room for wildlife and plant growth. Like Andrew, I also visited Talk About Town and just to see what it was like, and it looks useful as a way to take the pulse of League City residents. It even leads off with a question of whether the respondent is a resident of League City. So if you're not a resident but spend time there, your opinion is also worth noting by the people that run League City. Now, this isn't something I'm likely to say about many small Texas cities, but I'm getting a sense that League City is almost progressive.
Shock horror.
Oh, my Lord.
Speaking of the Houston Arboretum, I heard just a few minutes ago today, actually, on the 21st, that around noon today, there's going to be some controlled burns in the Houston Arboretum area. So they're saying, you know, you may see those. If you see smoke rising from the Houston Arboretum, don't call 911 because it is fine. It is controlled and the fire services are monitoring it. So,
yeah, typically that means that fire services are on site just in case. And again, from League City PD upgrades tasers with goals to limit deadly force and reduce harm. Again, from communityimpact.com. The League City Police Department obtained new tasers and received training on them in hopes that they can be used to help prevent the use of deadly force and protect department staff. From February 6th to 8th, 121 League City police officers received training on the Taser 10 from Axon, which is a technology and weapons company that develops products for military, law enforcement, and civilians. Tim McCurley, the department's training division lieutenant, said the department's goal is to de-escalate any scenario where harm may come to a civilian or an officer. The new Taser 10 will replace the department's old model, the X26P, which McCurley described as a one-shot wonder, as the two-probe Taser had significantly less accuracy, he said. Some of the Taser 10's features include audible and visual warning alerts, enhanced data management, a maximum range of 45 feet versus the X26P's 20 feet, 10 individually targeted probes, and advancements in accuracy, effectiveness, and reliability. McCurley said it was a requirement for all officers below the rank of captain to receive the training, including detention officers who work in the jail system. There are approximately 135 sworn officers staffed, he said. In 2022, Axon launched its moonshot goal to cut gun-related deaths between police and the public in half by 2033. The company publishes a public safety gun fatality database in collaboration with the Institute for Intergovernmental Research, an independent nonprofit research firm, to this end. Though the upgraded equipment still is not 100% accurate, it does give League City PD more options than they had before, McCurley said. The goal of having an intermediate weapon is actually to save the suspect's life and the officer's life, McCurley said. It prevents the officer from having to use deadly force. Andrew?
Having tasers is better than only having guns, and having tasers be more useful in more situations at least gives officers fewer excuses to use deadly force. But this expense isn't really making anyone safer, because ultimately the problems with policing are structural. Community needs being waved away as police responsibility instead of being taken seriously and funded as their own departments, formal and informal protections for police who use force and threats when they aren't needed, the supply of military surplus to police departments that enable unnecessary force to be used against thousands of people at once, these are just some of the core problems with policing that tasers and training don't solve. In fact, by increasing funding to police departments, they arguably make these issues worse. Ultimately, I wouldn't call this article bad news, but since it doesn't mean any real progress on the problems with policing, I can't call it good news either.
I substantially agree with Andrew's comments on law enforcement. I also like the availability of upgraded tasers offering more alternatives to the use of deadly force. It would be nice if tasers, in the absence of a suspect waving around a firearm, it would be nice if tasers were the first resort, as opposed to using an officer's firearm. It's worth emphasizing that de-escalation skills, proper training in when and how to use tasers, and also having non-police services to deploy when appropriate are also important. Again, from communityimpact.com, Bel Air Mayor talks drainage, commercial development in state of the city conversation. Newly elected Bel Air Mayor Gus Pappas gave his thoughts on several ongoing city initiatives at a State of the City event hosted February 15th by the Bel Air Business Association, weighing in on upcoming drainage decisions and efforts to build up the city's commercial development. Overall, Pappas described the state of the city as very strong, referencing a list by the online real estate company Open Door that ranked Bel Air as the 12th most family-friendly city in the U.S. based on outdoor recreational opportunities. Citing a growing interest among families to move to Bel Air, Pappas said it will be important for the city to continue to develop its business districts, which he said would help increase sales tax revenue and lower tax burdens on property owners. Ongoing efforts to update the city's comprehensive plan will work toward that end, he said, and there is a link to a story about the city's comprehensive plan from January. We need to make sure the people in Bel Air and the surrounding areas that they will come in and see they don't have to go to the Galleria, Pappas said, that they can get the things they need here. It's not only a good thing for our residents, but it's practical and it helps us pay the bills. About 63% of the city's $26.5 million general fund revenue for the 2023-24 fiscal year comes from property taxes, according to city budget documents. The city historically stays within its budget, Pappas said. We don't spend money we don't have, and I think that's incredibly important and a bit unique for most governmental entities, he said. Well, actually, a lot of governmental entities have laws that say they have to stay within their means. But going on. Meanwhile, the city is projected to have roughly $92 million in bond debt by September, according to budget documents, debt the city has taken on for street and drainage work and other infrastructure projects. That's, in other words, what's often called good debt. Pappas said the city typically pays off around $6 million in debt annually. With regards to major drainage projects, Pappas said the city is actively engaged in identifying all potential sources of funding for a Cypress Slough Ditch project. It took me a little while to get that in my mind. That falls outside of city limits and could cost as much as $90 million. The Harris County Flood Control District, or HCFCD, could come in as a funding partner, he said. Another looming decision will involve acquiring land along the ditch that the city can use during heavy rain events before sending it to Braes Bayou, Pappas said. We have to start someplace, and our focus at this point in time is getting Cypress Ditch in a position where we could drain into it, he said. Looking at our streets and drainage so that we can have our own capacity to store the water that gets to us in a way that doesn't flood our homes, and then get it to Cypress Ditch and ultimately get it into Braes Bayou and away from the city. I included this story mainly as part of my interest in local news that's useful to publicize. Looking back at Community Impact's earlier story on Bel Air's comprehensive plan, I noted that, quote, potential removal of multifamily residential development, unquote, was one item mentioned at the time, and that made me curious. If that's still an item in the plan, then how does it correlate with being the 12th most family-friendly city in the U.S. and a growing interest among families to move to Bel Air? By definition, multifamily residences make room for more families and more individuals in less space. So what does this mean in practice, Andrew?
In practice, it looks to me like Bel Air is trying to be friendly to rich families first.
Possibly. I would also imagine that multifamily dwellings pay more taxes per square foot of land than single-family dwellings, and this is based on my understanding that these sorts of structures don't qualify as homesteads for purposes of taxation and are fully taxed based on their appraised market value. I hope Bel Air isn't just trying to keep out the riffraff. I'll be interested in seeing further information on this as it develops. The Houston area as a whole needs to be very forward-thinking in terms of flood mitigation, so it's important that Bel Air, as a sovereign city within Harris County, do its share of flood control planning for its own benefit and as part of a greater Harris County flood strategy within the context of a master plan within the Harris County Flood Control District. As such, I think it would be both appropriate and necessary that the HCFCD partner on the Cypress Slough Ditch so that others outside of Bel Air can also share in it for flood mitigation. And I do have a link to the January 2024 story that Bel Air plan update zeroes in on commercial development. So you can also refer to that if you wish. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m., Thursdays at 6 p.m., and Sundays at 1 p.m. We're also on Google Podcasts, which can be downloaded from both the Android or iPhone app stores. We heavily excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com, which is now the homepage. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type keywords into the search bar. Shows now are about 80% scripted, so you can visually scan episodes' text to see if there is one particular topic in which you might be interested. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and look for me on Threads and Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own websites.
Yes, I do.
Or something at, like that. Account. That's the word I was looking for.
I own Twitter and Tumblr. And no, I do
you
not.
You do?
And I wish.
I had no idea I was in such elite company.
Oh, boy. I'm at DominateI on Twitter and Tumblr and on YouTube, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and YouTube.
And we've made some pretty stupid jokes right there. Okay, from the TexasTribune.org. After bruising loss in Houston mayoral race, U.S. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee faces her toughest re-election yet. In 1994, Sheila Jackson Lee, then a 44-year-old Houston City Councilwoman, unseated four-term U.S. Representative Craig Washington in the Democratic primary, securing a seat she'd come to hold for the next 30 years. This March, former Houston City Councilwoman Amanda Edwards, 42, is hoping to replicate that political upset as she faces off against Jackson Lee in the Democratic primary for Congressional District 18. Jackson Lee, who did not respond to requests for an interview, has only drawn four primary challenges over her 14-term career, all of whom she defeated by landslide margins. She's a household name in her Houston-based district, known for her frequent visibility at constituent graduations, funerals, and baby showers. But last year, she ran for Houston mayor against then-state Senator John Whitmire. It was a bruising primary, unfamiliar territory for Jackson Lee, and her campaign was roiled with negative media after audio of her berating her congressional staffers was leaked. She ended up losing the race by 30 points and then immediately announced she was running for re-election in the U.S. House. Edwards, a former Jackson Lee intern, initially announced she was running for Houston mayor until the congresswoman threw her hat in the ring. At that point, Edwards pivoted, endorsing Jackson Lee as mayor and beginning her own bid for Congress. By the time Jackson Lee announced she was running for her House seat again, Edwards had already gained momentum. In the fourth quarter of last year, Edwards outraised the congresswoman 10 to 1, 272,000 to Jackson Lee's 23,000. Jackson Lee and Edwards are also facing off against another primary Democratic candidate, Robert Slater Jr., who is a chef and business owner. He has not reported raising or spending campaign money this election cycle. If no candidate gets a majority of votes in the March 5th primary, there will be a runoff election in May. Edwards, a native Houstonian, said her commitment to public service is propelled by her father's battle with cancer when she was a teenager, where she learned firsthand about the cracks in the healthcare system and how policy could be a matter of life and death. She served as an at-large Houston City Council member from 2016 to 2020, where she represented a constituency of more than 2 million people. In her race to beat Jackson Lee, Edwards has garnered some notable endorsements, including Craig Washington, who previously held the congressional seat, and former Harris County Democratic Party Chair Lily Schechter, as well as progressive groups, including the county's Young Democrats and its chapter of the Texas Coalition of Black Democrats, both of which endorsed Jackson Lee in past races. The Harris County Young Democrats rescinded its endorsement of Jackson Lee in the mayoral race after duly endorsing both her and Whitmire, citing a zero-tolerance policy for staff abuse. In an interview, Edwards acknowledged that Jackson Lee may be a weaker candidate because of her bid for mayor. It certainly has a strong influence on how people are choosing to think about this election cycle in particular, she said. Despite any damage she may have incurred from her mayoral run, Jackson Lee remains a powerful political force in her district. County Commissioner Rodney Ellis, who is backing Jackson Lee, said he doesn't know anyone in local politics with her energy level, and that Jackson Lee has secured meaningful federal grants for her district, most recently $20.5 million to Harris County Public Health Department's Uplift Harris Guaranteed Income Pilot Project. He also said she has a reputation for being a reliably progressive voice in Congress. Jackson Lee has a long list of powerful endorsements from House Democratic leaders like House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries and Minority Whip Catherine Clark. She's backed by Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo and former Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner and other members of Texas's Washington delegation, including Democratic Representatives Lizzie Fletcher of Houston, Lloyd Doggett of Austin, Henry Cuellar of Laredo, and Joaquin Castro of San Antonio. Jackson Lee may not be a strong fundraiser, but she will benefit from her incumbency and advantage, Ellis said. Name ID is the only thing you can buy in an election. If you raise enough money, you can't really buy a record, he said. Linda Bell Robinson, a Houston Democratic precinct chair, said she is fighting for Jackson Lee to retain her seat because seniority in Congress is important and Edwards would be learning the ropes as a freshman if elected. We need fighters, she said. We don't need people trying to learn how to fight on the battlefield. We need people who are already fighting and know how to fight their fight. Andrew?
I would disagree that seniority should be the deciding factor between two candidates. In the House, the only institutional benefit to seniority seems to be, according to Wikipedia, what kind of office space you get. In the Democratic Party specifically, seniority influences committee assignments. Now, that can be useful, sure, but only if you agree with the policy outlook of the candidate given that position. Ms. Bell Robinson's position reads to me as being a very party-focused one rather than a policy-focused one, which is perhaps unsurprising for a party precinct chair. Still, I think policy matters far more than potential for power, because whether power is good or bad depends on the policy of the person attaining it. Even if the party's policy outlook is different from the individual's and has far more momentum behind it, we've seen many times in Congress how one person can hold up or totally sabotage a party's policy goals. Plus, the Republican Party in recent years has shown that even a whole party's platform can be wrenched away from its original direction. In that case, having individuals in office who will put doing the right thing ahead of being useful for their party can be the only way to bring the party back to its roots. Now, this isn't to say that I have a preference between Sheila Jackson Lee and Amanda Edwards or Robert Slater Jr. We'll see as more news comes out if I agree with one of them more than the others. But as it's not my district and not my party, for now, I'm content to sit back and watch.
Now, first, I have to disclose that Sheila Jackson Lee has been my representative in Congress for a very long time. And seniority has its place and its uses in Congress. It can determine what committees you're on, the relationships you have, the seriousness with which your ideas and positions are considered. It's also an example of how institutional knowledge becomes increasingly helpful. After some time in a position, whether in Congress or in business, you learn how to get things accomplished, what procedures are best used, and the people and assets that are available to accomplish your goals. I admit that this article gave me pause, however. The word seniority has more than one meaning, and both apply to Jackson Lee, And again, in the interest of full disclosure, they also both apply to me. A question to consider is, when is it time for a new generation to govern? When do the ideas and real-world experiences of youth get a turn at the table? And the reports of verbal abuse of staffers are not to be dismissed. Both candidates have noteworthy endorsements, making any guidance that's worth it into a close call. I've decided how I'm voting, and I'll be interested in seeing how things go. And because this is technically a nonpartisan station, I'm not telling you how I'm voting. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM HD2, 89.5 FM HD2 in Galveston, and 89.7 HD2 in Huntsville. We are Houston's community media. We now air Wednesdays at 11 a.m., Thursday at 6 p.m., and Sundays at 1 p.m., all Central Time. At Think Wing Radio, we scour the news for stuff you may not know, may not have heard, and we need your support to keep doing that. Plus, donate to KPFT. Call 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-5738 extension 1. Or go online to kpft.org and make your pledge of support to keep commercial-free community radio on the air in Houston by clicking the donate button. Then, each time you turn on the radio, you can hear your dollars at work. When you donate to KPFT, your dollars pay for transmitter and equipment costs, progressive talk shows like Think Wing Radio, Politics Done Right, and other locally generated political talk shows, KPFT's online streaming service, and maintaining a wide variety of local and regional music programs. So, KPFT depends on your financial support to keep bringing you Think Wing Radio. Consider becoming a monthly sustainer for $5, $10, $20, or even $100 per month. The consistent cash flow from sustainers helps KPFT to better plan their budget, and there are special thank you gifts for sustainers. Contribute whatever you can and pick the show you're supporting. No amount is too large or too small. It's all tax deductible. Call 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-5738 extension 1. Or give online at kpft.org. You'll be glad you did. Our next story is from the Texas Tribune. In her re-election bid, Representative Sean Feary tests whether Democrats will tolerate anti-LGBTQ votes. That Senate Bill 14 would pass was not in doubt. The legislation, which would bar gender transitioning care for children and teens, had universal Republican support and merely awaited final sign-off by the GOP-led House. The only surprise that May evening in the Capitol was when Representative Sean Feary, a Democrat from Houston, strode to the front of the chamber and announced she was breaking with her party to support the bill. Children must be protected from transgender care because of the risk of harm, she said, citing precedent in Texas for allowing only adults to get tattoos, use tanning salons, and purchase tobacco products. She said teenagers' brains are not developed enough to make potentially irreversible medical decisions. She said this debate was never about erasing trans children in a tearful 12-minute speech. For me, this discussion is about how to best protect and care for these children as they navigate through the challenging journey of finding the best version of themselves. Feary's remarks ignored that treatment decisions for minors can only be made by parents or legal guardians, as well as the consensus of major medical groups that gender transitioning care should be available to children and teens in the care of doctors. Republicans were quick to praise Feary as a brave politician willing to buck her radical party. To Democrats who watched the speech in stunned silence, she had betrayed their party's commitment to protect LGBTQ+ rights and vulnerable Texans. It feels defeating when you're a Democrat in the Texas legislature, said Dallas Representative Jessica Gonzalez, one of several gay members of the caucus. The last two legislative sessions had the most conservative bills. That's why it's even more important for us to stick together. The political fallout is spilling into the Democratic primary, where in her bid for re-election, Feary faces two challengers. One of them, labor organizer Lauren Ashley Simmons, is well-funded and has secured the support of several Democratic officials, including sitting House members and progressive groups like the influential Houston LGBTQ+ Political Caucus. A Democratic club in Houston censured her, accusing Feary of turning her back on the gay and transgender community. Thierry, whose small dollar donations have largely dried up, now relies heavily on wealthy Republican donors to fund her campaign. More than a third of Thierry's donations over the past year came from individuals or groups who typically support Republican candidates, a curiosity in a predominantly Democratic district. They include $10,000 from Doug Deason, a conservative activist, and $15,000 from his pro-school voucher family empowerment coalition PAC. While she's not the only Democrat in the House to have voted with Republicans on those bills, Thierry's race has become a referendum on whether elected officials who do not fully support LGBTQ plus causes can remain in good standing with the Democratic Party. Thierry is insistent she can and said her votes last year reflected the will of her constituents. Thierry, who declined to sit for an interview but spoke briefly to the Texas Tribune by phone, said most of the criticism of her LGBTQ plus issues comes from white progressives outside her district who do not represent her base of more socially conservative religious black voters. "I didn't just jump out against my constituents," Thierry said. "Clearly, I have a good pulse of how the majority of the people in my district feel. I really do. I've lived here forever." But it's a knife in the back of gay and transgender residents in District 146 who previously viewed her as an ally. The LGBTQ plus advocacy group Equality Texas endorsed Thierry as recently as 2022. Ashton Woods, a gay man and founder of Houston's Black Lives Matter chapter, accused Thierry of lying about her constituents' support for her LGBTQ plus positions. He said the representative previously presented herself as an ally of the gay and transgender community, but in reality is solely interested in the views of a small group of mostly elderly supporters that agree with her. "I don't know who she's talking to in my age group," said Woods, 39. "She's seeking a safe space where people share the same ideology as her." Woods, who unsuccessfully challenged Thierry in the 2020 Democratic primary, said her votes on LGBTQ plus issues last year were a reason why she has decided to run again. Joelle Espute, a black transgender woman in Thierry's district, said she had doubts about the sincerity of Thierry's commitment even before the votes. "The district has always been represented by a black Houstonian. Thierry was selected in 2016 by Democratic precinct chairs as the party's nominee for the seat after then-Representative Boris Miles resigned to run for the state Senate. She was elected unopposed." In the following sessions, Thierry voted reliably with her party. She joined most of the Democratic caucus in their 2021 protest of a GOP voter restrictions bill, where they absconded to Washington, D.C. for several weeks to shut down the House. It was an opportunity to follow in the footsteps of her mother, a civil rights activist who integrated Sharpstown High School in Houston. In the 2023 regular legislative session, Republicans made sexuality and children their top social issue. By the time lawmakers adjourned in May, much of the camaraderie Thierry had built with fellow Democrats unraveled. Three major pieces of legislation proposed by Republicans became law last year: a bill aimed at removing sexually explicit books from school libraries, a designation critics feared would be used to target LGBTQ plus literature, a requirement that transgender college athletes play on teams that align their sex assigned at birth, and the ban on trans minors from receiving gender transitioning care. Thierry supported all three. She was not the only Democrat to break ranks. 11 others supported the book banning bill, but she was by far the most outspoken in her support for the legislation. She said in another floor speech that the book bill would set up guardrails against explicit materials that have infiltrated schools, noting one that she said teaches children how to access dating websites. Fellow Democrats told the Tribune they were especially frustrated that Thierry did not support their efforts to offer compromises on the transgender bill. Thierry skipped the vote on the item, as well as all 18 other Democratic amendments. Thierry said that her positions reflected the views of her constituents. Community leaders in Sunnyside said LGBTQ plus issues are not the ones they think most about. Sunnyside Civic Club President Tracy Stevens, 66, recalls when the neighborhood was a bustling center of black life in Houston with its own movie theaters, bowling alleys, and grocery stores. After decades of neglect and underinvestment, he said Sunnyside needs a representative that will secure funding for street repairs and strengthen penalties for pollution. He commended Thierry for being accessible and attentive to these needs. Stevens also said he supported Thierry's stances on the book rating and gender transitioning care bills. These weren't issues when he was a kid, he said, adding that he understood Thierry's desire to protect children. Sandra Massey-Hines, who earned the nickname the Mayor of Sunnyside for her civil rights work in the community, said her focus lately has been helping elderly residents, at risk of homelessness because of rising rents. When it comes to gay and trans issues, Hines said she supported Thierry's votes. She said exposing children to LGBTQ plus materials is confusing for them. But younger residents and those with gay or trans family members said Thierry's stances are hurtful and don't represent the largely progressive district. Gender transitioning care, including doctor-prescribed hormones, makes life bearable for a 16-year-old transgender in District 146, their mother said. The Tribune granted her anonymity after verifying her identity and address because Governor Greg Abbott has authorized state officials to open child abuse investigations into parents who provide gender-affirming care to their trans children. Those investigations are on pause due to a lawsuit filed by Texas families against the state. The child came out as trans at age 7. They had a mental health crisis at 10, a common occurrence for children suffering from gender dysphoria, a type of psychological distress that results from a mismatch between a person's sex assigned at birth and their gender identity. Their mother said at the time she did not understand the kind of support they needed. Gender transitioning treatments have significantly improved the teen's mental and physical health, she said. They can just go to school, do the SATs, get their driver's license, and think about who they're going to take to the spring dance, she said. It freed them up to have a developmentally normal life as opposed to where they were at prior to this care, which was a dark place. The mother said she wished to share her experience with Thierry as lawmakers considered SB 14, but said her Capitol staff declined to schedule an appointment. She said aides said constituents could visit the office at any time to see if Thierry was available. The mother said it was impractical to make the 3-hour drive from Houston without a guarantee. Thierry's chief of staff said she makes time to meet with visitors, even if it requires stepping away from legislative business. Now that gender transitioning care is banned, the mother said she has made a plan to move to a different state if necessary, a step other Texas families with trans children have already taken. Anger with Thierry over her votes last year has created an opening for labor organizer Lauren Ashley Simmons, with a faction of Democrats coalescing around her. Simmons, who has never before sought elected office, said residents encouraged her to run after a video of her criticizing the state takeover of Houston ISD exploded in popularity online. With 2 children in the district, Simmons was worried about Republican attacks on public education and felt Thierry was unresponsive to constituents about the issue. She was shocked to see Thierry's remarks on SB 14, which she felt were ripped from the Republican national agenda. Why not make a 12-minute speech on the most pressing issues on District 146, she wondered, like gun violence and the lack of grocery stores. Simmons has captured some of the marquee Democratic endorsements, including labor unions and Planned Parenthood. Democratic leaders, including Houston City Controller Chris Hollins, former Harris County Democratic Party Chairman Otis Ebbegaru, and 3 House Democrats have also backed her. 2 Black Democratic House members, Representatives Barbara Gervin Hawkins of San Antonio and Nicole Collier of Fort Worth, have endorsed Thierry, as have local groups including the Houston Black American Democrats and the Harris County chapter of the Texas Coalition of Black Democrats. Collier disagrees with Thierry's vote on SB 14, but she said Thierry has been a devoted Democrat on other issues and does not deserve to be purged from the party. Collier praised Thierry as a skilled and hardworking legislator who has done much for her district. Other Democrats view it differently. There is room for the party's elected officials to offer lukewarm support for the LGBTQ plus community in moderate districts, they believe, but not in one that has the highest shares of Democrat voters of any in the state. Andrew?
Hey, I think I was just talking about this. Support for Thierry is significantly about what she can do for her party, and the Republican Party, too, considering some of her donors. Whereas support for Thierry's opponents, Ashton Woods and Lauren Ashley Simmons, is more based around policy, what they do for the people they'd serve in their district and across Texas. And I think I've already made it clear that I think policy is far more important than party power. It also occurs to me that when Thierry says she was representing the will of her constituents, she's not strictly wrong. If you ask a question of a large enough group of people, you're likely to hear every opinion under the sun. So, yeah, there's at least one constituent of Theories who wanted her to vote exactly the way she did, with exactly the reasoning she had, and could serve as her excuse. But whether that opinion is shared by the majority of her constituents, as she claims later in the article, that's a lot harder to tell. Without polling every single resident of District 146, the closest she could come to that is measuring the opinions of people who were able or felt safe enough to contact her about it. And that's already a self-selecting sample. Ultimately, Theory's decision was hers, and the consequences are hers too.
This article also jogged my memory of her vote at the time, and I was not at the time happy about it, but I'm not one of her constituents. I do kind of think that when you have significant donations, 4- and 5-figure donations from the opposition party, that by itself can start to become maybe disqualifying. I think this is a useful article that raises some basic questions about the nature of representative democracy and what that means in practice. Voters tend to choose representatives that seem to align with their values and beliefs. That's as it should be. But what happens when a representative senses that their constituents have views that in some areas differ from their own? Do they ignore those opinions and vote their own? Or do they swallow their pride and vote as they believe their constituents might want them to? When is an elected official bending with the wind versus doing as their constituents might prefer in spite of what their party or their own values might dictate? If one is fair and open-minded, this is a conundrum. Andrew's point about whether Theory has correctly determined the values and wishes of her constituents is also valid, as is the question of whether doing the right thing as one sees it should outrank the preferences of even a majority of voters. Essentially, when elected to lead, does one lead from the front or the rear? When considered in these lights, it's a tough question. But again, as Andrew points out, the consequences are Theory's either way. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central, Thursdays at 6 p.m., and Sundays at 1 p.m. You can also hear the show by visiting archive.kpft.org for episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. We heavily excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com, which is now the homepage. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-5738 extension 1. And you may even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Just ask. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and I'm on Threads and Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
I do indeed. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on YouTube, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and YouTube.
Our next story is from the New York Times. It's actually from last week, but still appropriate. Zombie offices spell trouble for some banks. Graceful Art Deco buildings towering above Chicago's key business district report occupancy rates as low as 17%. A set of gleaming office towers in Denver that were full of tenants and worth $176 million in 2013 now sit largely empty and were last appraised at just $82 million, according to data provided by TREP, a research firm that tracks real estate loans. From San Francisco to Washington, D.C., the story is the same. Office buildings remain stuck in a slow-burning crisis. Employees sent to work from home at the start of the pandemic have not fully returned, a situation that, combined with high interest rates, is wiping out value in a major class of commercial real estate. Prices on even higher quality office properties have tumbled 35% from their early 2022 peak, based on data from Green Street, a real estate analytics firm. Those forces have put the banks that hold a big chunk of America's commercial real estate debt in the hot seat, and analysts and even regulators have said the reckoning has yet to fully take hold. The question is not whether big losses are coming. It is whether they will prove to be a slow bleed or a panic-inducing wave. The past week brought a taste of the brewing problems when New York Community Bank stock plunged after the lender disclosed unexpected losses on real estate loans tied to both office and apartment buildings. When a string of banks failed last spring, partly because of rising interest rates that had reduced the value of their assets, analysts fretted that commercial real estate could trigger a wider set of problems. Banks sold about $1.4 trillion of the $2.6 trillion in commercial real estate loans set to mature over the next 5 years, based on data from TREP, and small and regional lenders are especially active in the market. Economists and regulators feared that heavy exposure to the dicey-looking industry might spook bank depositors, particularly those with savings above the $250,000 limit for government insurance, and prompt them to withdraw their funds. But government officials responded forcefully to the 2023 upheaval. They helped sell off failing institutions, and the Federal Reserve set up a cheap bank funding option. The actions restored confidence, and bank jitters faded from view. That has changed in recent days with the issues of New York Community Bank. Some analysts are dismissing it as a one-off. New York Community Bank absorbed the failing Signature Bank last spring, accelerating its troubles. And so far, depositors are not pulling their money out of banks in large numbers. But others see the bank's plight as a reminder that many lenders are in for pain, even if it doesn't spur system-wide panic. The reprieve the government provided the banking system last year was temporary. The FUD's funding program is set to shut down next month, for instance, but commercial real estate problems are lasting. Commercial real estate is a wide asset class that includes retail, multifamily housing, and factories. The sector as a whole has had a tumultuous few years, with office buildings hit especially hard. About 14% of all commercial real estate loans and 44% of office loans are underwater, which means the properties are worth less than the debt behind them, according to a recent National Bureau of Economic Research paper by Erica Zhuwei Zhang from the University of Southern California and two other colleagues. While huge lenders like J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America have begun setting aside money to cover expected losses, analysts said, many small and medium banks are downplaying the potential cost. Some offices are still officially occupied, even with few workers in them, what Hendry calls zombies, thanks to years-long lease terms. That allows them to appear viable when they are not. In other cases, banks are using short-term extensions rather than taking over struggling buildings or renewing now unworkable leases, hoping that interest rates will come down, which would help lift property values and that workers will return. Bank-reported delinquency rates have remained much lower at just above 1% than those on commercial real estate loans that trade in markets, which are over 6%. That's a sign lenders have been slow to acknowledge the building stress, said Mr. Piskorski, the Columbia economist. But hopes for an office real estate turnaround are looking less realistic. Return to office trends have stalled out. While the Fed has signaled that it does not expect to raise interest rates above their current level of 5.25% to 5.5%, officials have been clear they are in no hurry to cut them. Lonnie Hendry, chief product officer at TREP, expects that delinquencies could nearly double from their current rate to touch between 10% and 12% by the end of this year. And as the reckoning grinds on, hundreds of small and medium banks could be at risk. The value of bank assets has taken a beating amid higher Fed rates, Mr. Piskorski and Ms. Zhang found in their paper, which means that mounting commercial real estate losses could leave many institutions in bad shape. If that were to rattle uninsured depositors and prompt the sort of bank runs that toppled banks last March, many could plunge into outright failure. Their paper estimates that dozens to more than 300 banks could face such disaster. That might not be a crushing blow in a nation with 4,800 banks, especially because small and medium lenders are not as connected to the rest of the financial system as their large counterparts, but a rapid collapse would risk a broader panic. Officials at the Fed and the Treasury Department have made it clear that they are closely monitoring both the banking sector and the commercial real estate market. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said during the congressional testimony that commercial real estate is in an area that we've long been aware could create financial stability risks or losses in the banking system, and this is something that requires careful supervisory attention. Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, acknowledged during a 60 Minutes interview that aired on the previous Sunday, that there will be losses. For big banks, Mr. Powell said the risk is manageable. When it comes to regional banks, he said the Fed was working with them to deal with expected fallout and that some would need to close or merge. It feels like a problem we'll be working on for years, Mr. Powell admitted. He called the problem sizable, but said that it doesn't appear to have the makings of the kind of crisis things that we've seen sometimes in the past, for example, with the global financial crisis. Andrew?
I think it's a safe bet that there isn't one magic solution to these impending troubles. But one thing I think could help would be for many of these empty buildings to pivot from office space to residential space. Think about it. Counts of houseless people reached record highs in 2022, according to the National Alliance to End Homelessness. That isn't because there aren't enough homes. There was a high of over 750,000 active single-family and condo housing listings that same year, according to data from Realtor.com. It's because housing is becoming increasingly expensive. An article from The Zebra cites the average home price as almost $350,000 in 2022. All of this data is for the United States, by the way. At first glance, it might seem like building more housing in a market that already has a surplus of it isn't going to help. And this might not be a magic solution for the housing crisis either. But a major increase in the amount of available housing should, according to the laws of supply and demand, push prices for all homes in the U.S. downward. Now, this would make housing more affordable and could help more people renting to be able to afford to purchase their own home, which would free up rental properties, which houseless people are more likely to be able to afford, at least in the immediate term. And if people are living in these empty buildings, some of this excess space could be used for convenient retail, helping to use the space for purposes that are, if not the same, at least adjacent to their original intent. Of course, there are complications with this plan. Many places in the U.S. have zoning laws and different construction requirements for business versus residential properties that would make pivoting empty offices in this way difficult without going through rezoning and retrofitting processes. And at a deeper level, there are structural factors at play that come with the extractive nature of capitalism, like the fact that real estate is such a common speculative market, which inflates prices in the manner of a bet at the poker table. These factors might limit the effectiveness of my proposal and would mean that any plan for immediate relief wouldn't stop a future crisis. But I still think my idea, or another idea similarly outside of the box, could make a difference for at least some people who need a house and some people working at a bank that isn't looking so good. I think it would be hard to make the economy any worse this way, at least, because retrofitting means construction spending, which means jobs, which means business expansion, which means loans, which banks like. I think it's worth a shot.
I'm going to just touch back on something you said about increasing the housing market as more residential opportunities grow. Mm-hmm. And that is, you could end up then, over the next decade, perhaps seeing a housing crisis where housing values go underwater compared to the loans they have.
Somewhat similar to what's going on in China right now with the real estate market.
Yes, which one of these days we will get to talking about.
One of these days.
One of these days. Anyway, we did do a show in March of 2020. I think it was the March 23rd show, and I've linked to it. Unfortunately, no text, but it's going to be in the back half of the show, where we speculated on how COVID might influence the shape of life in the future, and a discussion of commercial real estate was among those items we talked about, and how some of that office space might be repurposed for residences. I think we're seeing some of those predictions mature now. Andrew is correct that commercial building codes are usually very different from residential building codes, but in the case of commercial high-rises, they tend to be stricter. For example, high-rise buildings usually have sprinkler systems for fire suppression. Wallboard is thicker. Partitions use steel studs. Windows in newer buildings are insulated glass with sunshading film, so they're already somewhat energy efficient. The electrical core systems are probably very robust, but each space is always wired specific to renters' needs anyway. I see the biggest problem is plumbing. Office buildings are designed for central restrooms, whereas residences will need adequate water and waste service provided to individual units. Trash chutes would also have to be retrofitted, but none of these modifications are beyond the realm of feasibility. As for partitioning spaces, these apartments could be rented or sold as high-ceilinged lofts that can be assigned open floor plans by each individual tenant. The converted units might also be sold as condominiums to upper-middle-class families and individuals. Increasing living units would not only have the potential of reducing rents generally, but might also free up older housing stocks that would be made more affordable as a result of their vacancy and age. So we'll have to see how this unfolds, but I think it's not an unmitigated disaster, but there will be pains.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, in the last couple of minutes we have before the show ends, you know, you did mention the possibility of a future crisis down the road. And I think that that's not something that we should just sort of gloss over. You know, let's explore that a little bit. That's true. And I think that that is in some ways a result of those, what was it, core or capitalistic inherent. There we go. Inherent limitations that I talked about. But there, it's not like that there's no way to counter that, right? You know, you need to be careful with the different ways that these houses are released onto the market. Because as the article mentions, a lot of these empty office spaces have existing leases that are still active and aren't up yet. And there's a couple
people. A slow burning crisis, I think, is more or less the term that was used.
Right. But what I think that could do in terms of staving off a future potential crisis is that it would only open up some of these office buildings for redevelopment as, you know, in bits at a time, waves at a time. And that might help make it less of a shock to the market when these buildings do come onto the market.
On the other hand, one of the things businesses do is go bankrupt, or sometimes they have like small LLCs that they are holders of, and the small LLCs can go bankrupt and get out of a lease that way.
True.
So, you know, business has ways of avoiding debts and legal obligations in ways that individuals and small businesses simply do not have.
Yeah,
so it's not foolproof. I would not rely upon just waiting for the leases to expire in the normal scheme of things. And I also do think, and I remember going through a savings and loan crisis during the Reagan years, where because there had been some go-go loans and some fast and loose accounting, that it took a decade and hundreds of billions of dollars to get that settled. And as we've discussed in the past, from my perspective, money doesn't just grow on trees. You can't just print it. Otherwise, you have runaway inflation. So
true.
If the money is put toward resolving bad debt and trying to keep the economy liquid, you're still in a position where that money is not available to go to other things, whether you believe in national defense or you believe in
social services,
better education, whatever, the money simply would not be available. So I think we're looking for a very difficult decade or two in the future. Okay, I think that wraps it up. So we'll have some stories to carry over to next week. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston at 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 89.7 HD2. We are Houston's community media. My co-host, indispensable editor, and assistant producer is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting and look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. Y'all take care.
See you later.
Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the store. Why don't we cross the bridge together?
Stories come to life at your local parks and forests. They're places of wonder, and they're closer than you think. Make the forest part of your story today at a local park near you, or find one at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
This is Brian Levinka, and today I'd like to talk to you about supporting KPFT. Why should you support KPFT? It's a radio show that's been on for almost 40 years, Queer Voices, that is, and it was started as a way to reach people that couldn't be reached. I know growing up outside of Houston, I used to listen to KPFT when I was little, and I had hope that there was someone out there that knew was like me and knew what I was going through. I am the executive producer now for Queer Voices, and I wouldn't ask you to do something that I don't myself do already. I do support KPFT monthly with a donation, and I ask that maybe instead of buying a cup of coffee, donate to KPFT. The riches that you get from donating to KPFT are more valuable than that cup of coffee that will disappear in a few hours. Why is LGBT programming important in Houston? Well, I think we're seeing from the legislature in Austin that our voice is even more powerful and more important these days as we move forward in these trying times. We need a voice in the darkness that calls out to the Rainbow Kids of the Future. Please consider supporting KPFT and Queer Voices. Show that we have listeners and that we have support out there in the ether. And I'm always reminded of what my friend and the great Anise Parker once said, give all you can until it hurts and then just give a little bit more. That's how you know that you're making a difference. So kpft.org is where you can make your donation. Please specify Queer Voices or you can call 713-526-5738. Thank you.